Hello, everybody. This is Keith Pannell, and welcome back to another Science Studio. Today, we're going to continue our conversation with Douglas Olsheroff. He was the Nobel laureate, you remember, that we were talking to last week about his key investigations into superfluidity of an isotope of helium that we call shorthand helium-3. Douglas, welcome back to Science Studio.
It's great to be here. Of course, I'm at home, but that's all right.
Well, the audience didn't know that until you let them into a secret.
Sorry about that.
Right. But I think what our listeners, and certainly I, would be interested in, just to remind the listener, that you received the Nobel Prize in 96, I think, for work that was done in 72. And that was work that you did as a graduate student working in a group of a mentor. Now,
Yes. What
happens after that? You've got your PhD, and now you've got to start to think about your own research. How did you decide what then to continue with? Even though you didn't know, of course, in those days, in the early 70s, that you were going to get such recognition, what did you decide to look into in terms of research?
Well, you don't. First of all, you don't do it that way. You're skipping a whole bunch of steps there. I mean, I was a graduate student, you're correct, at Cornell University. My wife was in a two-year postdoc, so we basically got done at the same time. I was very fortunate in that I was interviewed by the people at Bell Laboratories, specifically Venki Narayanamurthy, who's now a dean of sciences at Harvard or something like that. And they decided to offer me a job. Of course, you know, it was interesting. I came down to give this talk, I think it was in January or something like that. So the discovery was made in November, and we hadn't a clue as to what it was that we discovered. So it turns out in the audience, there were two people. One was Phil Anderson, of the Anderson-Morrell state. This is one of the two superfluid phases that I discovered, but of course we had no idea what it was that I discovered. And the other one was Dick Werthammer of the Ballion-Werthammer state. It was really completely ironic. I thought at this time we thought that these transitions were in the solid. So I gave this talk, and everything I said, other than about the data, was wrong. But it was exciting, and I was, of course, excited. And so they offered me a job, and I went to Bell Laboratories. I think I left Cornell in July because there was a large international low-temperature conference in Boulder, Colorado that summer. And then I went from there to New Jersey. Well, we went back to Ithaca. We put all of our belongings in a trailer, and then we hooked it up to the car and drove down to New Jersey. And so at Bell Laboratories, you had total freedom. They supported you nicely, and there were lots and lots of people around that were interested in what I was doing. So it was fantastic. And I spent the first 5 years doing nothing but understanding superfluidity in helium-3, I mean, what it was that I discovered. Part of it, of course, was out of curiosity. Part of it was, there's something called the Jocelyn Bell effect. I don't know if you know who Jocelyn Bell was, but she was the person that didn't get the Nobel Prize for, I think it was pulsars or quasars. The point is, women were unfairly overlooked for Nobel Prizes before. I didn't want to be overlooked. I didn't want to just be the graduate student that was there turning the knobs when this discovery was made.
Then you did your 5 years of continuous investigation into what you discovered. And
right.
This was a joint project then with the other folks at Bell Labs.
Well, I mean, I was the only experimentalist. I was mainly working with theorists. But Bell Labs was fantastic. I had no other responsibilities. I didn't have to write research proposals or teach or anything like that. And I could spend, I was probably for a long time working close to 16 hours a day, but it was mostly during the daytime. I mean, my wife and I would get in around noon, and I would work until, that was actually when we were at Cornell. It was sort of a continuation of that kind of business, though. At Cornell, we would get in at noon, have dinner on campus at 6 p.m. At midnight, I would take her home, go back, and work until 4.
So that was your modus operandi.
Yeah, and I would say it didn't change all that much, except at Bell Laboratories, our jobs were 30 miles apart, so we lived kind of halfway in, maybe closer to 50 miles apart. We worked halfway in between.
I think the listeners would be interested. I mean, the Bell Labs was obviously run and financed by the Bell phone system in those days, where before it was deregulated. And, you know, there are many programs we could do on the rise and fall of laboratories of that nature. But try and tell the audience why it is that Bell Labs would invest so much in you and the other groups that were working with you, the theoreticians, to understand the concept of the superfluidity.
Yeah, well, look, I'm not absolutely 100% sure of this, but what I've been told is that Bell Labs, well, first of all, it was not just Murray Hill Bell Laboratories. That's where I was. There were several facilities. Most of these had about 4,000 people in them, so these were not trivial operations. The only two that did a lot of basic science were Murray Hill, and photonics was done at Holmdel. But as I understand it, the funding for the basic research came from the license fees from the regional operating companies. And I believe that money couldn't be used for anything else.
Okay, so but I mean, I'm just wondering what you would tell a layperson was one of the potential offsprings of your discovery.
Well, okay, there's no, I would say, no practical uses for superfluid helium-3. The temperatures are so close to absolute zero. I mean, a device that gets to these low temperatures today costs typically $250,000. So it'd have to be one hell of a spectacular application for it to merit the cost. And, you know, these things are not transportable and all that sort of stuff. But superfluid helium-3 was the first example of what we call unconventional BCS states, which are, you know, other examples are all the high-temperature superconductors. So there are states where the Cooper pairs have internal structure.
Right. We discussed that a little last week. Yeah. So after the 5 years then, did you then begin to think, well, there must be some other things that I can be interested in or am interested in to sort of push the boundaries of your and our scientific knowledge?
Well, it was interesting. Okay, you know, you kind of focused in on what you're doing and you love it and you think it's the most important thing in the world. After 5 years, Joe Burton, I think was the name of his director of the Physical Research Laboratory, called me in his office, and he reminded me that I'd been there 5 years, and then he said, and you've done nothing but study superfluidity in helium-3. And, you know, I started feeling very uncomfortable, and he said, don't you think it's time that you do something else?
All right. And, okay, so you did get that impetus, even at the Bell Labs.
Yeah, well, it was kind of gentle, but it was actually rather different from that, too, because at Bell Laboratories, I knew that he was going to continue supporting me. What he'd done was given me a hunting license to go out for entirely new science.
Right.
And so when I walked out of his office, I felt, you know, would like to look for a crack in the floor to fall through. I realized that more and more I was measuring numbers rather than discovering new behavior. And he had given me this hunting license, and so I started thinking about it. And, you know, within a few months, I decided that I would go back. No one had, my PhD thesis was supposed to be understanding nuclear spin ordering in solid helium-3, which no one had ever seen by that time. And so by this time, people knew that there were phase transitions, but no one knew what the nature of the ordered phase were. And so I decided I would go back and use the technology that I developed to understand superfluid helium-3 to try to understand nuclear spin ordering in solid helium-3. And that ended up happening so quickly. It was amazing. There were two theorists, Daniel Fisher and Mike Cross, who were sort of working with me. We used, you know, the NMR frequency shifts in the solid. Boy, it didn't take long before we knew exactly what the nature of the ordered state was. There were actually two ordered phases. One was already understood, but the other one, no one had a clue.
So again, and, you were the experimentalist and they were the theoreticians, or did you
right,
now
absolutely,
have a
yeah, you're correct. Yeah, so I was the only experimentalist.
So you didn't have another, after your 5 years apprenticeship, your tenure decision to go and study spin ordering, you weren't given more technicians to work for you or anything like that?
Well, I had a technician and he was very good, but you know, he was a he was German, and his training was in automotive engineering. There was one set of data that I let him take, and I never understood that set of data.
And it was it repeated?
Well, you know, it's a long time to go in and do this. Anyway, so I basically would farm him out to other members of my department.
You mean if they had problems with their motor cars or they wanted to do some science?
No. If they needed a technician to help them with an experiment.
But I'd like to go back to that, though. So the one set of data that he collected, you never went back and had somebody else or yourself try to reproduce that data that you didn't understand.
Yeah, I think that's right. Look, if I thought it was very exciting data, I probably would have.
Okay, so a decision, an executive decision was made.
You know, it's funny that at that time, you know, the amount of data that was coming in was just amazingly high. You know, you only want to publish things that you really feel strongly are complete and correct.
Well, that's another story that we could talk about another time, because there's always the feeling, at least in a university, that if you've, for example, taken the responsibility of getting graduate students or postdocs and you put them on a project and they get results, but then it turns out not to be quite as exciting, even though it's new, there is a bigger compulsion to want to publish that, because just for the student's point of view or the postdocs, showing that they've been involved in this sort of work.
Absolutely. Well, that's... The PhD thesis is what shows that these people can actually do research.
Right. So anyway, then how long did you stay at the lab?
It was 15 years. I would say that by the time I left, the Bell Labs was beginning to change. Specifically, MCI had brought antitrust suit against AT&T, and AT&T had decided that it would settle out of court because I can't remember how this worked. They felt they could win this somehow. And so they were forced to divest themselves from the regional operating companies. And as I probably told you, at least it's my belief that the funding for basic research came from the license fees from the regional operating companies. And the thing is that if you looked in the other areas of Bell Laboratories, the applied areas, Area 52, device physics, these guys would, in fact, start out the year with money for what they called forward-looking research. So this was not part of some program that Bell Labs needed a device to come out of in 6 months or something like that. This is for people that had some idea that there's something they could do that would be new and come to lead to new technology. But usually about halfway through the year, Bell Labs would be behind in delivering a diode laser repeater for an undersea communication system, you know, undersea fiber optic cables. And so they would basically need to put on another shift, and to do that they would terminate the basic research that was going on.
All right. So anyway, when you decided to leave, we'll come back to that in a moment, but just to remind our listeners, you're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're talking with Douglas Osheroff, the Nobel laureate of 1996, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. If you could spend a small amount now to save billions of dollars later, would you do it? That's what the Alzheimer's Foundation is proposing.
Its focus is on 5 years. By delaying the onset of Alzheimer's by just 5 years, we'd save hundreds of billions in healthcare.
The Foundation's recent report suggests by investing $2 billion a year starting in 2015, the savings of successfully delaying Alzheimer's would pay for the cost of research in just 3 years.
How? Because treating Alzheimer's is expensive. Today it costs Medicare $154 billion. That's 20% of its budget. By 2050, the total cost will skyrocket past $1 trillion.
If, however, a new treatment by 2035 delayed the onset of Alzheimer's by 5 years, almost 6 million people would not develop Alzheimer's by 2050. That's a savings of nearly $90 billion for families and $370 billion for the federal government.
Here's another sobering fact. The proportion of those with early and moderate versus severe stages of the disease will shift to the right by 2050. What does this mean? Well, in early stages, people function well and the financial impact is low.
In the moderate stage, memory lapses and confusion become apparent. Then in the final, severe stage, people need extensive daily care. This stage will impact half of Alzheimer's cases in 2050.
The effect could be devastating unless an investment is made now. Several studies have the potential to make the 5-year delay a reality. Even though President Obama has pledged $100 million a year, it's a mere start. We need much, much more.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Douglas Osheroff, Nobel Laureate 1996, superfluidity for helium-3. And we're talking about his time at the Bell Labs. And then finally, then you left after, as you said, 15 years. What was the thought process when you left? What were you then looking forward to doing?
Well, let me say that the decision to leave was probably not mine. My wife is a professional scientist, biochemist, and she had been working in pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey. These are drug companies, but they generally employ organic chemists, not biochemists. And so she felt that she was not being properly appreciated, and we'd gone to Bell Laboratories because that was absolutely the best place where I could possibly be, and it was time that we moved somewhere so that she could have, you know, a more appropriate job. And so the first job offer she got was from Amgen, which is in Thousand Oaks in California. And if we'd gone there, we would now be independently wealthy. Amgen has done very well since that time. But then she got an offer from Genentech, which at that time was the preeminent biotech company in the world. And they're in South San Francisco. That's how I ended up at Stanford. And she stayed there for, I can't remember when it was, but eventually she was interested in something that Genentech was not interested in.
So how long were you at Stanford before you got the call from Norway?
Oh, God, let's see. It must have been about 7 years because it was, if I remember, so it was 96 and I came in 87.
All right. Now, in that period of time, you want to concentrate. What was your research concentration?
Well, okay, so I came and I was doing a mixture of liquid and solid helium-3, still trying to understand these things, and use helium-3 as a system to look at broader aspects of magnon thermal conductivity and things like this.
But now you had graduate students working with you.
Right, right.
And how did that change the way that you looked at how science is performed? Because it's a big difference, right, going from 15 years in the Bell Labs and then now suddenly having students that have their own ideas, their own schedules, etc.
Yeah, well, I had some very bright students, and I didn't notice there was much of a difference there. I suppose, you know, you have to mentor these kids, but it's still, you know, a lot of it is finding potentially interesting research problems to put them on.
Right.
But the thing is, there's something that you need that I guess call critical mass. And I felt that the NSF is going to give me at most enough money to support two graduate students, and that just wasn't enough. So I decided I had to do something else, and so I thought about what things that I was interested in, and one was the dielectric properties of glasses. These are dominated at low temperatures by what are called two-level tunneling systems. So you think about a glass, and you think there's no motion going on there, but there's a lot of motion inside the glass. And so I got an early student working on glasses, and then one day these guys were measuring the dielectric constants as a function of temperature. You get logarithmic dependence with temperature. And then I suggested one of these students, you're measuring the dielectric constant with an AC signal. That's typically what you do it, an oscillating signal. I said, what happens if you apply suddenly a DC signal, a large DC voltage on top of that? Is that going to change the dielectric constant? And we thought about it. We said, okay, so you got these two-level tunneling systems. You can think of them as electric dipoles if you want, and some of the splittings are going to be increased and some are going to be decreased, but in the end you'd say it should be the same. And so we tried it. By God, that's not what we saw. So the dielectric constant jumped up, and then it relaxed backward logarithmically in time, which is, you know, no difference.
Right.
I mean, there were cases where people had seen things like this in other systems, but it's very unusual to see beautifully logarithmic behavior in time.
And so that was another breakthrough for you.
Well, it was, yeah, sort of a breakthrough,
right.
And so I, for many years, I had two groups, because the techniques were all the same. It, you know, it wasn't that they were independent groups. They were involved in their research, but in fact, these cryostats that I use to get these low temperatures consume about 30 liters of liquid helium a day. Uh-huh. And that's the cost of that is
that's
so
helium,
high.
That's helium 4.
That's helium 4,
much,
right?
Much cheaper.
Yeah. The cheap stuff.
Yes,
but it's,
right.
But it's not that cheap if you throw it away. So I got my own helium 3, helium 4, a helium 4 liquefier, not helium 3 liquefier. Right. But the graduate students had to run that. But things went well for a long time, I
That's
think.
Great. Then, can we move ahead to the day after you got the prize? You told us last week about this telephone call that they thought you'd be interested no matter how early in the morning it was in California.
Yeah.
But now all of a sudden you've got this, it's not exactly a dilemma, but I remember we had a conversation on this program with Bob Curl down at Rice.
Right.
And he said, you know, then you now look at yourself in the mirror. You know, he didn't say these exact words, but here I am. I've got this tremendous recognition for work that I've done. What do I do in the future? Because you were still a young man, relatively young man. It's not like you know, got this when you were in your 80s. You got it when you were still a very active research scientist. And so you have a dilemma. Do you just carry on doing research that may be, you know, just very nice, but it's never going to get that recognition that the original work, or do you somehow become a bit of an oracle on behalf of science? Did you find that as an issue that you had to address?
Absolutely. And I mean, at first I tried to continue doing both, but as time went on, I think it was really a matter of the fact that I wasn't thinking about what I should be doing next in my lab. I was going around and giving talks. Let me tell you, in the month of November, I basically was on the road for 18 days. So only 12 days were back at Stanford, so to speak. And, you know, that's not the way to run a research program. But, you know, I think I am able to inspire young people pretty well. In fact, at some point, I asked myself the question. I thought that, look, I'm 65, I'm near retirement at some level anyway. And I always thought that when I retired, I would go back in the laboratory and behave like a graduate student, like I did when I was at Bell Labs. But then I said, geez, you know, if I do that, it's no more travel, because the dilution refrigerator requires constant attention. You can't go away for a few days. You have to dump liquid helium in it every day. And so I thought, you know, what's more important for me, to get 3 or 4 good research papers out, or for me to go around and inspire tens of thousands of kids?
And so you chose the latter, obviously. And how does that work? What's a typical trip for you? How are you sort of presented, if you like, to the young people around the world interested in science?
Well, it depends on where you're going and what kind of science they're doing there. I mean, certainly the science in Mexico is, generally speaking, not at the level of the science in the next place I'm going, which is Israel. I really like to give talks where I describe rather clearly the process of science, because I think the kids really understand then what it's all about and how to do it.
What is the process of science as you perceive it?
Well, first of all, I think scientists have to be broadly knowledgeable. You have to go to conference, realize what's going on. You have to look at the developments, both the scientific developments and the technological developments. And then you think about those two things and how that impacts what you're doing or what you'd like to do. And, you know, then you get ideas. And so I give examples of various people. Heikki Kamerlionis, the person that first liquefied helium back in 1908, you know, he was in a competition with Dewar to see who could first liquefy the lightest and most inert of the atmospheric gases. And, you know, there wasn't a big, you know, it was technology that they were doing. I don't think they were doing much science. And then Kamerlionis liquefied helium. And then what they'd done was then found out where the substance would solidify by typically pumping on the vapor until you can do that with water. And of course, it solidifies at 0 Celsius, or 273 Kelvin. so Cabernet was found he couldn't solidify helium. Well, helium doesn't solidify under its own vapor pressure. You have to apply 25 bars of pressure. And so he eventually, after 2 years, gave up on that, which was a good thing. And he looks around for some other question of the day that he can answer with this wonderful unique refrigeration device he has. And people were arguing about what would happen to the electrical conductivity of very pure metals as they were cooled to absolute zero, or as close as you could get. And so one argument was that as you cool them, you get rid of the lattice vibrations that scatter the conduction electrons, and so the electrical resistance would slowly drop towards zero. But the other school of thought was that the conduction electrons, which are not attached to any atom but are free to roam around the interior of the metal, would recondense on the ions from which they'd come, and all electrical conductivity would cease. And so he gives this sample, a very pure sample of mercury, to Gilles Holst, who was, I don't know, his graduate student or postdoc or something. Or I don't know what the term was back in those days. And he's measuring the resistance, and at about 4 degrees, the resistance discontinuously drops to as near as they could tell zero.
Right.
Of course, that was a discovery of superconductivity.
Right. I mean, and your point is well taken, that technology and the instrumentation is something that often leads scientists to make major discoveries. Because
right.
if you
and
don't have that instrumentation, you're scuppered.
Frequently, these discoveries are serendipitous. And people don't understand how often that happens, that something, you know, someone's doing something and they discover something completely different. Another good example was the cosmic microwave background radiation. Penzias and Wilson were testing this microwave receiver that Bell Laboratories had given them. Bell Labs had used this in early experiments on satellite telecommunications. And so they were just testing it out, and they found that there was this low level of background noise
that they couldn't get rid of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that was the background to the Big Bang. But I gather there's some new theories that say that some of this is, in fact, predates the Big Bang. I just read that on the BBC Science magazine this week. So that they're saying, oh, perhaps there's energy out there before the Big Bang that we're not paying attention to.
I have no idea.
Well, not why. I don't suppose anybody does, but it's just another new approach. You're absolutely right about serendipity, though, and sometimes that makes it very difficult when you're trying to get money, because that's what we all do, spend a lot of time trying to write grants and getting money, that sometimes, you know, you can't always say what it is that really you've got a sense is out there.
Right, absolutely. And so what you need to do is you obviously have to propose a piece of research that you think you can do anyway.
Right.
And then I think, you know, use your equipment and your imagination, look for something else with it.
Douglas Osheroff, we've got to stop here, all right? We've run out of time. Must say, it's been great fun to have you here on Science Studio, and we thank you for your contribution to science and your enthusiasm of wandering around the world giving talks to the new generation of scientists. And long may you do it and enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together, and you, the listener, for listening. We'll be back again next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.